Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. This is where we take a massive stack of source material, some of the most cutting-edge, complex research out there, and we really just distill it down into the core knowledge you need to be genuinely informed.
And today, we are wading into a really new frontier in metabolic science.
We are. We're focusing on the tiny yet, well, mighty world of mitochondrial-derived peptides.
Specifically, we've got an exceptionally exciting and, I have to say, complex set of papers to analyze. We're going to be peeling back the layers on something called MOTSSC.
MOTSC. And this is a peptide that sits right at the intersection of, well, everything interesting: energy metabolism, muscle function, insulin sensitivity, and even the biology of aging.
It really is. And, you know, since its foundational discovery, it's been lauded as the next great exercise mimetic.
And that label, exercise mimetic, is just so incredibly compelling, isn't it? But as always, with this kind of breakthrough science, the gap between stunning preclinical results, you know, what happens in a petri dish or a mouse, and an established human therapy can be, well, immense.
It's a chasm.
It is. So our mission today, and this is tailored specifically for you, the learner, is to thoroughly assess that evidence stack. We need to separate the robust mechanistic facts that have been established in the lab from the, let's say, limited and often contradictory human reality.
The goal here is total clarity. We want to make sure you understand the profound biological potential while, you know, maintaining a healthy skepticism about its current clinical utility. We're going deep, moving beyond the headlines to the critical molecular and clinical details.
And before we pull on our waders and jump into the mitochondria itself, we want to acknowledge that this deep dive, like all of our explorations into cutting-edge science, is produced by InfinityPeptide.com.
So let's frame the central question we're trying to answer as we go through all this data. Given the incredible preclinical promise, how close is MOTSC truly to becoming a widespread therapeutic reality?
And just as importantly, what are the critical, you know, the unresolved safety and measurement gaps that absolutely have to be addressed for this science to progress responsibly?
Because the sources are very clear on this, those gaps are substantial.
Okay, let's unpack this right from the beginning. We absolutely have to start with the foundational biology, because the very discovery of MOTSC challenged a fundamental belief in cellular science that had stood for decades. So what exactly is MOTSC, and why did its identification just shake things up so much?
Right, so MOTSC stands for a mitochondrial-derived peptide, and it is a very, very small chain, only 16 amino acids long.
Which puts it in the micropeptide category.
Exactly. But the truly paradigm-shifting detail here is its genetic origin. It's encoded directly by mitochondrial DNA, or mtDNA.
And we really have to remind everyone listening that for decades, this was basically scientific heresy, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
The long-held dogma was that the mitochondrial genome, that little ring of DNA inside the cell's powerhouse, was almost entirely dedicated to encoding only the machinery for cellular respiration. You know, ribosomal RNA, transfer RNAs, a handful of proteins, that's it.
Precisely. The entire field viewed the mitochondrial genome as this highly streamlined ancient machine. It was thought to, you know, essentially only keep the blueprints it needed for the nuts and bolts of energy production.
The idea that it could do more was just out there.
The idea that mtDNA might encode complex signaling molecules, peptides designed to communicate with the rest of the cell and alter global metabolism, that was radical, truly radical.
It's sort of like finding out that the wiring harness in your car isn't just carrying electricity, but it's also capable of sending these sophisticated regulatory software updates to the engine and the brakes at the same time. It completely repositioned the mitochondria.
That's a great analogy. And the foundational paper, which our sources trace back to 2015 from Dr. Pinchas Cohen and his collaborators, published in Cell Metabolism, it didn't just find a new peptide. It established the existence of a whole new class of bioactive molecules, mitochondrial-derived peptides, or MDPs, that act as these endogenous regulatory factors.
And that foundational paper, the one that really set the whole field on fire, it centered its findings on rodent models. What was the core finding that immediately catapulted MOTSC into the limelight?
The initial findings were spectacular, just spectacular in terms of metabolic health. The researchers reported that giving MOTSC to mice regulated their muscle metabolism, it significantly improved their insulin sensitivity, and it was extraordinarily effective at preventing diet-induced obesity.
Even when they were eating junk food, basically.
Yeah, even when the mice were fed a high-fat diet. It was, in essence, restoring metabolic balance homeostasis in the face of severe nutritional stress.
And that leads us right to that initial very sticky label that caught everyone's attention, the exercise mimetic. What does that actually mean at a cellular level?
It means that the peptide mimics the specific cellular and metabolic signals that are normally activated by physical exercise. So think about what happens when you run or lift weights. Your body is forced to become metabolically flexible. Your muscle cells suddenly get way better at pulling glucose out of the blood and better at burning stored fat for energy.
And MOTSC seemed to do the same thing, but without the workout.
It appeared to achieve those same results. Specifically, and this was a huge finding, it enhances glucose uptake in muscle cells independently of insulin.
Wow, which is massive for treating insulin resistance.
Massive. So what we're talking about here is a small mitochondrially encoded peptide that acts as a powerful signaling molecule.
So what kind of message is this molecule sending out to the rest of the cell, or, you know, the whole organism?
It's primarily functioning as a mitochondrial stress response peptide. So when the cell or the organism experiences metabolic duress, whether that's from, say, a constant bombardment of excess sugar or the low-grade inflammation of obesity, or even just the natural decline that comes with aging MOTSC levels increase.
So it's like the cellular SOS signal being dispatched directly from the power plant.
That's exactly it. It communicates with the rest of the cell to maintain metabolic homeostasis. It's essentially sending out a signal saying, hey, we need to switch fuels and increase efficiency now. And by doing that, it prompts muscle and liver cells to act young and metabolically agile again.
It's a newly recognized and apparently essential piece of that intracellular conversation that helps the cell survive and, you know, maintain function when it's under stress.
Yes, and understanding that this signal originates directly from the mitochondria fundamentally changes how we view diseases that are associated with mitochondrial dysfunction, like type 2 diabetes and sarcopenia.
So that establishes its revolutionary origin and its powerful role as a systemic metabolic signal, at least in animals. This really lays the groundwork for why the mechanisms, which we're diving into next, are so critical to understand.
Now that we appreciate the unique origin of MOTSC, let's dive into the core of the excitement. This is the robust preclinical evidence detailing the specific molecular pathways that MOTSC targets. This is where the source material is strongest and, frankly, the most detailed.
Okay, so let's start with what a lot of researchers call the master switch for cellular energy, the thing that controls whether we store energy or burn it.
Right, that would be the AMPK pathway. MOTSC is reported to primarily and potently activate something called AMP-activated protein kinase, or AMPK.
AMPK.
And if you think of the cell's energy status as, say, a bank account, AMPK is the chief financial officer. It's constantly monitoring the ratio of AMP, which is a sign of low energy to ATP, which is high energy.
And if that bank account balance starts looking a little low, the CFO AMPK has to start making some tough budgeting decisions.
Precisely. When MOTSC activates AMPK, it shifts the entire cell into conservation and burning mode. And critically, AMPK isn't just sensing energy levels. It's actively deciding the cell's fate. It turns off energy-expensive processes like building new fat and protein, and it shifts the cell toward catabolism.
Meaning it starts burning through stored resources, whether that's glucose or fat.
Exactly. So the functional downstream effects of this activation are exactly what you'd want in a metabolic disease: increased glucose uptake and enhanced fat oxidation.
So how does MOTSC actually achieve this activation? Is it unique compared to, say, a drug like metformin, which also targets AMPK?
That's a really excellent question. Our sources highlight that MOTSC's mechanism appears to be quite unique. It doesn't just activate AMPK generically. The 2015 discovery actually mapped out that MOTSC gets its powerful metabolic benefits through a specific folate purine AMPK-dependent mechanism.
Okay, that's a mouthful. Can you break down that sequence for us?
I'll try. So think of it this way. The folate and purine metabolic pathways are crucial for things like cell growth and making DNA. When MOTSC is present, it seems to modulate the intermediate products of these pathways.
Okay.
And that, in turn, leads to an accumulation of AMP, the low energy signal. This unique input is what potently and consistently activates AMPK.
So it's not the same as metformin?
No, it suggests MOTSC is communicating the cell's metabolic status via a previously unrecognized molecular language. It really distinguishes it from drugs that work by inhibiting complex I in the electron transport chain, which is how metformin works. It's a different way to get to the same switch.
That level of mechanistic detail really explains why the preclinical evidence is so compelling. We don't just see an outcome, we actually understand the specific molecular levers that are being pulled.
Indeed. Now, moving past that global energy regulation, let's focus on the muscle, which, as you know, is often called the largest metabolic organ in the body.
Right, and MOTSC is deeply connected to preventing age-related muscle decline or sarcopenia. This is where that exercise mimetic label really, really shines.
Absolutely. The research findings consistently link giving MOTSC to the regulation of muscle atrophy pathways. In animal models, it offers just profound protection from muscle wasting and promotes better recovery and adaptation to exercise.
How does it manage to do both of those things, both protect the muscle and improve its performance? Is it like directly building new tissue?
It acts primarily by taking the brakes off the existing growth mechanisms and preserving the tissue that's already there. The crucial finding here is its regulatory effect on myostatin.
Ah, myostatin. That's the famous one.
It is. Myostatin is a well-known, very potent negative regulator of muscle growth and mass. Its job, physiologically, is to prevent us from just becoming constantly over-muscled. It's a natural break.
So if you administer MOTSC, it reduces the activity of myostatin, which effectively removes the brake on muscle development and maintenance.
That is the functional outcome that's been observed in animals. You get enhanced metabolic flexibility, improved exercise capacity, and that crucial protection from atrophy, which is exactly why the anti-aging community is so intensely interested. It's tackling sarcopenia right at a key regulatory switch.
Okay, now here's where the science gets truly next level, moving beyond just simple signaling in the cell's cytoplasm. Our sources point to some cutting-edge mechanistic insights that suggest MOTSC is much more than just a metabolic regulator. It's a true signaling powerhouse.
Yes, and this really illustrates the sophistication of this whole MDP family. More recent work has identified direct interactions with specific targets other than AMPK. For instance, an enzyme called CK2, which stands for casein kinase 2.
And what does that do?
Well, this enzyme is known to affect muscle metabolism and atrophy pathways. So finding these secondary targets shows that MOTSC has this fine-tuned, multi-pronged approach to restoring muscle health. It's not a one-trick pony.
But the truly revolutionary finding, the one that elevates MOTSC from just a metabolic peptide to a fundamental cellular signal, is its role in the cell's command center, the nucleus.
This is the finding that confirms the mitochondria are genuine communicators. The newer research details this concept that MOTSC actually translocates. It physically moves from its origin in the mitochondria across the cytosol all the way into the nucleus, especially during times of cellular stress.
And once it's inside the nucleus, inside the machinery of the cell, what job does it take on?
It alters nuclear gene expression.
What?
It essentially acts as a transcriptional modifier, changing which genes are turned on or off to manage the current state of metabolic crisis or stress. It physically binds to DNA regulatory elements, to the chromatin architecture itself, and upregulates the expression of stress resistance factors and even longevity associated genes.
That is just a profound role. It means the mitochondria isn't just sending out some generic chemical distress signal. It's sending a messenger that directly rewrites the cell's response strategy from the very core.
Absolutely. This gives it a dramatic increase in potential impact, suggesting it could influence cellular fate far beyond just how it uses energy.
And what about other organs?
If we look at the broader outcomes in animal models, beyond just muscle and obesity, the benefits are systemic. In addition to improved systemic glucose uptake, we consistently see significantly reduced hepatic steatosis.
The accumulation of fat in the liver, or fatty liver disease.
Right, yeah. Which is a massive public health problem. So the preclinical picture is one of a multi-system therapeutic that is highly effective at managing metabolic dysfunction. It looks like a clear path to drug development.
But this... This brings us to the crucial pivot point in any deep dive. The transition from the lab bench to the human clinic. Okay, here we have to inject a heavy dose of realism. We've established that the mechanistic story is strong, it's supported by robust, repeatable animal studies. However, we have to establish clearly for you, the learner, that clinical human data on the native MOTSC peptide are extremely limited.
Yes.
And that clinical grade efficacy is not yet established.
That is the absolute most critical caveat. The science detailed in the potential of the mechanism is sprinting, but the rigorous clinical translation is still in the very early stages, moving at that cautious, regulated pace necessary for human safety.
So what kind of human data do we actually have?
We currently have three primary types, and each one is, well, it's fraught with limitations.
Okay, let's start with the observational biomarker studies. The research that's just trying to figure out what normal human MOTSC levels are and how they correlate with disease.
Right, so researchers will draw blood. They'll measure the circulating MOTSC plasma levels in various human cohorts, thousands of people who are lean, obese, diabetic, or healthy. And then they statistically look for correlations with metabolic disease, aging, and physical activity.
And what do they find when they start measuring these levels? Do we see a consistent signal that, you know, MOTSC is low in sick people and high in healthy, active people?
Unfortunately, no. The findings are highly variable and often flat out contradictory, which is the first major complication for translation.
How so?
Well, for example, some studies published around 2018 and 2019 show, as you would expect, decreased levels of MOTSC in individuals with severe obesity or type 2 diabetes. And this aligns perfectly with the peptide's protective role we see in the animal models.
Okay, that makes sense.
But other equally reputable studies report the opposite, or at least very confusing results. Other researchers report positive correlations between higher circulating MOTSC levels and insulin resistance, particularly in certain cohorts of lean individuals.
Wait, higher levels are correlated with a worse outcome?
In some studies, yes. And then a third group of studies finds no statistically significant changes or just inconsistent age-related changes across the board. The published literature is this confusing mosaic, and it leads to contradictory headlines. Is MOTSC a marker of good health, or is it a marker of the body struggling against metabolic stress? We don't know.
So why is the data so messy? This takes us to the core measurement challenge, which is maybe the single biggest scientific hurdle facing this peptide right now.
The problem lies in the methods. It's how they're quantifying the peptide. Researchers are using widely disparate assay methods, and the results are just not comparable. Specifically, labs are split between relying on ELISA, which is an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, and the far more precise method of LCMS, or liquid chromatography mass spectrometry.
Can you explain the practical difference between those two methods and why it leads to such different results?
Sure. ELISA is fast and relatively inexpensive. It uses antibodies to bind to the target peptide. But that's also its weakness. MOTSC is so small, and it's often cleaved into fragments, so the antibodies can suffer from high cross-reactivity.
Meaning they might accidentally grab onto similar but not MOTSC peptides.
Exactly. Or they might miss the peptide entirely if it's in a slightly different shape. So you get inaccurate, potentially inflated, or just inconsistent measurements.
Whereas LCMS is different.
LCMS is the analytical gold standard. It separates all the plasma components based on their chemical properties and then uses a mass spectrometer to identify the exact molecular weight and amino acid sequence of the peptide. It's far, far more accurate.
And what happens when you compare the two methods on the same blood sample?
The results are wildly divergent. Our sources confirm that one lab using ELISA might report a concentration that is 10 times higher or lower than another lab using LCMS.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't reliably and consistently measure the concentration of the circulating peptide, you cannot reliably draw clinical conclusions about its relationship to disease. It compromises every single observational study.
And that's before we even talk about sample integrity. The peptide itself is pretty unstable, right?
Yes. It's notoriously susceptible to degradation. Researchers have found that storage time, temperature, whether the samples were frozen and thawed correctly, all of it substantially affects the measured results.
So if a sample sits on a benchtop for too long before it's processed,
the measured MOTSC level could drop dramatically, which could lead to completely false conclusions about that patient's status.
Okay, so if your measuring tape is constantly changing length, and the thing you're trying to measure is also degrading before you can even get to it, the ability to compare any two studies worldwide is fundamentally broken. That explains the contradictory headlines.
It does. Until the field standardizes on robust, reproducible methods, ideally LCMS, the observational human data is going to remain a statistical muddle.
All right, so moving past the challenges of just measuring native MOTSC, we get to the interventional human testing. This is the most direct evidence of its potential therapeutic use. But since the native peptide is so unstable, this testing was done using a synthetic analog.
Correct. For practical drug development, the instability of native MOTSC is a major hurdle. So this synthetic analog, CB4201, which was developed by a company called CoBAR, was created to have better pharmacokinetic properties.
Meaning it just lasts longer in the body.
Exactly. And this is the only interventional human data we have that's directly related to the MOTSC mechanism.
The trials were phase 1A and phase 1B. What are those typically designed to do?
Phase 1 trials are almost exclusively focused on three things: safety, tolerability, and pharmacokinetics, how the body absorbs, distributes, metabolizes, and excretes the drug. They use small groups of people, usually healthy volunteers or individuals with very mild forms of the target disease. They're explicitly not powered or designed to prove efficacy.
And what were the key findings from these initial trials of the CB4201 analog?
The primary finding was positive. CB4201 was reported as safe and well-tolerated across the early dose ranges they tested, so they confirmed that the drug could be safely given to humans without causing acute major side effects. And that's the green light you need to proceed to phase 2.
But did they see any signs, any whispers of the kind of efficacy we saw in the animal models?
They reported what the industry calls encouraging signals.
Ah, encouraging signals.
Right. Biomarkers that showed positive trends in the direction of metabolic improvement. For instance, in people with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, or NFLD, they saw early trends showing a reduction in liver enzymes like ALT and AST, which is an important sign of reduced liver inflammation.
That is encouraging.
It is. They also noted improvements in trends related to fasting glucose levels and some positive changes in other liver fat biomarkers.
But, and this is a big but, we have to be very precise with our language here. That is a trend in a biomarker in a small cohort.
Absolutely. We cannot overstate this. These phase 1 results confirm only safety and tolerability. They do not establish clinical efficacy. They don't prove that this analog can actually cure or treat a disease in a meaningful way. And they certainly don't establish long-term safety. The road from phase 1 to an approved therapy is very long and very arduous.
And finally, we should note that MOTSC measurements sometimes pop up in other major human trials where it isn't the main focus.
Yes, that's the exploratory biomarker substudy context. Researchers will often add novel biomarkers to existing large trials just to gather data on human response. So, for example, trials studying the effectiveness of major drug classes like SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 therapies might include MOTSC measurement as an exploratory endpoint.
So in that case, we learn about the interaction between the approved drug and the body's natural MOTSC levels, but not about MOTSC as a therapy itself.
Exactly. These studies are useful for understanding human physiology, showing us how existing treatments affect our body's endogenous signals.
Yeah.
But they should never, ever be confused with actual therapeutic trials of MOTSC-TABC.
So the clinical bottom line really remains. The promise is enormous, but the evidence is currently limited to small, early-stage safety trials and that highly compromised observational biomarker data. The hype has run far, far ahead of the clinical certainty.
Given the intense interest in MOTSC, we really have a responsibility to spend significant time on the unresolved safety, implementation, and regulatory questions. These are the mandatory areas for future research and, frankly, the reasons why any current clinical use is scientifically unsupported.
Let's start with human variability. We know MOTSC is encoded by the mitochondrial genome, and we know that genome is subject to variation based on ancestry and environment. Do we know if MOTSC acts the same way in everyone?
We absolutely do not. And the initial data highlights that population heterogeneity is a major hurdle. First off, some research already suggests there are distinct sex differences in circulating MOTSC levels, and even in the metabolic efficacy signals we see in animal models.
So dosing and response might vary significantly between males and females.
They might. And that variability also extends to genetics, specifically the mitochondrial DNA itself. Our sources stress that variability is likely influenced by an individual's mtDNA haplotypes,
which are basically different ancestral lineages of mitochondrial DNA.
Exactly. Since MOTSC is encoded by mtDNA, different versions of that mitochondrial genome might influence the structure or the function or the stability of the peptide, which could lead to different responses based on ethnicity or geography.
So a peptide that works wonders in a model derived from one set of mitochondrial genetics might be completely ineffective or even cause an unexpected side effect in another population.
That is the core concern. This needs intensive, population-specific investigation before you can even think about broad therapeutic use. And beyond that, the variability also depends on the existing metabolic state of the person. The efficacy profile in a healthy 30-year-old athlete might be fundamentally different from a 65-year-old with type 2 diabetes and sarcopenia.
Okay, now let's tackle the elephant in the room. Whenever you're activating powerful growth and energy pathways, you have to talk about the theoretical risk of cancer. This is one area where preclinical data has to be reviewed meticulously before you advance.
This is one of the most critical unresolved safety dilemmas. The preclinical data on MOTSC in cancer is, well, it's deeply mixed, which creates a real dilemma. Some reports suggest potential anti-tumor effects in specific contexts, for instance, by correcting the metabolic dysregulation that drives some cancers.
Which would be a great therapeutic benefit.
It would. But its very mechanism promoting cellular health, growth, and metabolic throughput is precisely what tumors need to proliferate. The theoretical concern stems from MOTSC's strong mechanistic overlap with cellular growth and energy pathways. Remember, it potently activates AMPK, which is a key regulator of the MTOR pathway. And MTO is the master growth promoter in the cell.
So the worry is that if MOTSC over the long term pushes a susceptible cell toward enhanced growth and division.
There is a theoretical cancer promotion concern, or perhaps an acceleration of existing undiagnosed microtumors.
And right now, we have no human data to assess this long-term risk.
None whatsoever. There is no conclusive long-term human safety data set that screens for oncologic signals associated with MOTSC use over the course of, say, 5 or 10 years. And this type of screening, looking for any increased incidence of malignancy, is a mandatory non-negotiable component of any phase 3 clinical trial. Without it, the compound remains clinically unusable.
Let's move to a more immediate practical concern for patients who might be taking this, drug interactions. We discussed that MOTSC potently activates AMPK.
This necessitates a strong warning about potential drug interaction risks. The most widely prescribed AMPK modulating drug in the world is metformin, the frontline treatment for type 2 diabetes.
And metformin also activates AMPK, but through a different mechanism.
Right. It inhibits complex I of the electron transport chain. So what happens when you combine two different inputs that both converge on the same master switch?
The outcome is highly unpredictable.
It is. Combining these could lead to unforeseen additive or synergistic interactions. The dose might suddenly become too potent, risking profound hypoglycemia, dangerously low blood sugar, or other severe metabolic shifts, like lactic acidosis.
And clinical guidance on how to dose MOTSC alongside common drugs like metformin is
completely absent, which makes parallel use hazardous outside of a controlled trial.
Finally, we have to look at the regulatory and ethical surveillance aspect. If a peptide acts like an exercise mimetic, enhances muscle function, and improves metabolic profile in animals, you just know it's going to catch the attention of sports and anti-doping regulators.
It already has. Regulatory and anti-doping organizations like the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, USADA, and the World Anti-Doping Agency, WGATA, are actively monitoring MOTSC and its known analogs. They recognize its powerful potential for misuse in performance enhancement contexts.
So even before this compound is proven to treat any disease in humans, it's already being flagged as a potential doping agent.
Exactly. Because of its documented effects on muscle preservation and metabolic flexibility, this creates a really challenging regulatory environment. Industry leaders acknowledge that while they're positioning these analogs as the first wave of mitochondria-based therapeutics, their own reports confirm that phase 1 data is just preliminary. The path to acceptance requires multi-year trials addressing every single one of these safety and interaction gaps.
So we have these theoretical safety concerns tied to the very mechanism that makes it so exciting, and then these immediate practical concerns regarding measurement consistency and drug interactions. This context is absolutely vital for anyone tracking this research.
We've covered the depth of the biology and the complexity of the clinical reality. Let's now try to synthesize all this information and distill it into clear, practical guidelines, especially for you, the learner, who is tracking the legitimate scientific progress of this field.
I think we can draw some clear, consensus-based action points directly from the scientific reviews in our source material. So what is the most critical recommendation regarding its current therapeutic use?
The recommendation is explicit and unequivocal. It's to advise explicitly against using native MOTSC or its research analogs, therapeutically outside of strictly controlled approved clinical trials. We have to stress that human efficacy, optimal dosing, and most critically, long-term safety remain entirely unproven. Any current use is premature and operates completely outside the established scientific and regulatory framework.
And for the research community, the people who are struggling with those contradictory observational results we discussed, that assay variability, what specific steps are mandatory to move the science forward?
The field must urgently standardize its approach. The guidelines stress the need to standardize assay methods and sample handling procedures globally. This means meticulous control over sample storage time and temperature, making sure there's swift processing to minimize degradation, and a strong preference for using highly accurate methods like LC-MS where possible.
And why is that standardization so important right now?
It's the only way to generate human data that is actually comparable across different labs and cohorts worldwide. Without it, the field is just going to continue to produce conflicting results, making it impossible to establish what normal levels of MOTSC even are, or what levels correlate reliably with disease or recovery.
Looking ahead, for the companies developing analogs like CB4211, what's the mandatory next step for clinical science to responsibly translate this really promising preclinical work?
The necessary next phase has to prioritize three types of human studies: randomized, dose finding, and longer safety studies. These trials need to directly compare native MOTSC and optimized analogs against a placebo group with proper blinding. And crucially, they have to move past simple biomarker trends.
They need actual pre-specified outcome measures,
yes,
right?
They need to use hard pre-specified metabolic and safety endpoints.
Yeah.
Actual measures of outcome, like changes in HbA1c for long-term blood sugar, or whole body insulin sensitivity using gold standard clamps, or verifiable changes in muscle mass as measured by DEXA or MRI. Biomarkers are signals. These are outcomes.
And regarding safety, what specific monitoring protocols do these future trials need to implement to satisfy the concerns we just talked about?
Future follow-up has to be extensive and multi-layered. First, they must monitor intensely for interactions with existing AMPK active drugs like metformin to provide the data we need for future co-administration guidelines.
And so,
second, and most importantly, they have to meticulously screen for oncologic signals, any potential for cancer promotion, over a period that spans several years, not just the weeks or months of a phase one or two trial.
Without establishing that long-term safety profile, the peptide will just stall in development, no matter how promising the metabolic benefits might look.
That's the reality of modern drug development. Safety is the ultimate gatekeeper.
So let's bring this deep dive back to the surface and synthesize the final takeaway for you. What is the overall status of MOTSC today?
MOTSC represents a fascinating, relatively new chapter in mitochondrial signaling. The mechanistic story is robust and profound. The way it potently activates that master energy switch, suppresses muscle-wasting signals, and acts as a genuine cellular messenger by altering nuclear gene expression.
And that's all supported by strong, repeatable animal data.
It is. And the early human analog safety data does support continued cautious clinical development.
It is the definition of a promising compound. It could fundamentally change how we approach sarcopenia, insulin resistance, maybe even fatty liver disease. But here is the bottom line for you, the learner.
Until randomized, outcome-driven human trials are completed, until the massive problems of assay variability are resolved, and until the critical long-term safety questions are conclusively answered.
MOTSC remains a promising research peptide, not a scientifically supported or clinically established therapy. The biological excitement is justified, but the application remains premature.
And we'll leave you with this final provocative thought that really initiated this entire conversation. The discovery of MOTSC was revolutionary because it forced us to accept that mitochondria are not just the silent powerhouses we once believed. They are sophisticated communication hubs, signaling critical metabolic status to the rest of the cell.
So if one 16 amino acid peptide encoded by the mtDNA MOTSC can have this much potential impact on metabolism and aging, just consider this. The mitochondrial-derived peptide family is vast. What other unknown peptides like humanin, SHLP2, or dozens of others that scientists are still mapping are waiting to be discovered? And what fundamental aspects of aging and chronic disease might they be regulating in ways we haven't even begun to imagine?
That is the truly unbounded frontier for the next decade of metabolic research.
Thank you for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.
Very well.